On this 10th day of August, 2011, in San Diego, we're reading from the Srimad Bhagavad Gita as it is, translation and commentary by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. We are in Chapter 3, entitled Karma Yoga, and we are reading text number 32, I believe. Yeah, 32. 31. We did that. I remember reading that one. Ye tveta dabi suyanto nanu tinshtam di me matam sarva gyana vimudangstan vindhinashtana chetasaha. Translation. But those who, out of envy, disregard these teachings and do not follow them regularly are to be considered bereft of all knowledge, befooled, and ruined in their endeavors for perfection. Purport. The flaw of not being Krishna conscious is clearly stated herein. As there is punishment for disobedience to the order of the Supreme Executive Head, so there is certainly punishment for disobedience to the order of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. A disobedient person, however great he may be, is ignorant of his own self and of the Supreme Brahman, Paramatma, and the Personality of Godhead, due to a vacant heart. Therefore, there is no hope of perfection of life for him. Om jnanatimarandasya jnanandana shalakaya chakshu unminitam mena. That's my Sri Guruvenam, huh? I offer my respectful obeisance unto my spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, who opened my eyes with a torchlight of knowledge, although I was buried in the darkness of ignorance. Hare Krishna. So, Krishna now is providing a stark contrast between someone who follows these injunctions, these statements he's made heretofore in this chapter, and those who do not. And what's the difference? The envy. One is full of faith and anasuyanta, shraddhavanto anasuyanta, and the other is abhisuyanta, and therefore with no faith. Now, the injunctions are kind of summarized in text 30, which Srila Prabhupada says clearly indicates the purpose of the Bhagavad Gita. O Arjuna, surrendering all your works unto me with full knowledge of me, without desires for profit, with no claims of proprietorship, and free from lethargy, fight. So, this is an injunction to surrender to Krishna. And remember, this is a chapter on karma yoga, and karma yoga deals with acting in such a way that one is not further entangled in this material world, and one's works gradually liberate him from his existing entanglement. So Krishna will explain in the next chapter more detail. We have to know what is work, what is karma, what is our karma, and what is vikarma. Karma in that context means work that may be fruitive, but it's according to rules and regulations of the Vedas. So it keeps one within the boundaries of the Vedic injunctions. Vikarma is work that's outside those boundaries, and that is called vicious work, sinful activity, that deeply enmeshes one in this material world. It's spoken of famously by Lord Rishabhdev. Nunam pramatta kura devi karma yadindriya pritaya pranoti. Those who are simply concerned for sense gratification, that's their highest goal. They're not concerned with how they do it or what any restrictions may be. They must perform vikarma. And that vikarma inevitably brings them another body for suffering. And so Rishabhdev's opinion is it's not a very wise decision to act in that way. So here Krishna is giving in text 30, 31, and 32, the summary, more or less in 30, of all he's spoken before, how one can be free from karma, free from entanglement in one's by fruitive activity, surrendering it all to Krishna, free from false hopes and false sense of proprietorship. And this indicates one is free from envy as well and full of faith. Then one will become free from karma, free from the bonds of karma. But one who disregards this injunction and does not act in this way, then is completely befooled. even though on the material level one may be a very a great professor or a very a great writer of novels or philosophical works, but if one doesn't act in this way, this is after all about acting, karma yoga, and in knowledge and in faith, then all of one's knowledge is bewildered. Vimudha, one is a complete fool. And one is destroyed. Destroyed means the soul can never be destroyed, but one may very well lose the privilege of the human form of life. And that's considered to be destruction, at least for a long time. So here's a stark choice Krishna is giving us. We need to develop that faith in this process of Krishna consciousness, and to actually act in such a way that our acts are more and more acts of sacrifice for the pleasure of the Supreme. And the more that we're acting in that way and developing the consciousness that goes along with it, we'll be progressively freed from the bondage of karma and progressively become more advanced and Krishna conscious and have that sense of freedom from the bondage of the things of this world. So that's what's being spoken of here. This word abhisuyanto comes up again and again. It's really out of envy. You know, this is a kind of a basic point of philosophy, and that we're here to begin with. We're competing with Krishna. You know, we can't really compete with him effectively, but we're trying. You know, we'd rather forget Krishna and compete with him for sense gratification, for proprietorship. And in doing that, we are destroyed again and again. Our hopes for success in this world, for safety, for happiness, are all destroyed. Mogasha, moga karmano, moga gyana vachetasa, Krishna says in the 9th chapter, that those who have taken shelter of the bewildering energy of Krishna, they deride him. They have no regard. Abhajanati mamudha, manushim tanamashta, parambhava janaram mama bhuta maheshadam. Mogasha, moga karmana, moga gyana vachetasa, rakshasim asarim chata, rakshasim asarim chaiva, prakatim mohinim shita. So this is a very, you know, a severe statement. Krishna's not mincing any words here. There's only a few minutes to speak, and he's speaking very strongly. It says, those who deride me when I appear in the human form, not understanding my real nature as the Lord of all, all of their hopes, mogash, are baffled. They come to nothing. Their activities ultimately don't have any meaning. Moga karma, no. Their knowledge is really ignorance. Moga jnana. Vichetasaha. They're completely bewildered about the truth. And they have the nature of asari and rakshasa. Very strong. You know, demons and cannibals. Why? Prakriti mohinim shita. They have taken shelter of the bewildering energy of Krishna. And this is the material condition. You take shelter of the bewildering energy, but the bewildering energy does not provide you any real shelter. There's no shelter in this material world. You know that you can. It seems like there's places of safety and places of comfort, but they really aren't in the final analysis. And we're cheated again and again until we finally come to Krishna's lotus feet, which are the real place of shelter in this world. That nice verse that you're working on this one. Somebody told them, remember, samashitaye parapallava pravam mahatpatam punya yasho marari. This verse spoken by Shukadeva Goswami to King Pariksit after Brahma Vimohan Leela and after Brahma's prayers, which are very important. And then he speaks this verse shortly thereafter. So there in that verse is described how one who takes shelter, complete shelter. You know, I talked about how this prefix, we should watch for that, some. You know, sam means complete, sanyas, sankirtan, sanyas, samudaranti, in this case, samashrita, complete shelter, of the boat of the lotus feet of Krishna. In this instance, the world, the material world, is compared to an ocean. Imagine being in the middle of this ocean, or maybe just, you know, 10 miles out, you know, a big storm is coming up. You're helpless there. You're flailing around. That's really the condition we're in. Or if you prefer, you're in the blazing forest fire. Take your choice. You know. In both cases, great danger and you're in great peril of expiring. So that's the nature. So we need a boat. If you're in an ocean, you need a boat, right, for any kind of safety. And if you're in a forest fire, you need an inundation to save you. So both the inundation is compared to the mercy of Krishna, the mercy of the Guru, Sangsara Dava, another little loka, Tranaya. You know. That's the first verse of the Guru Vashtika. So here, compared to a boat, Mahapadam Punya Yasho Marari. Now the lotus feet are of whom? Marari, Krishna, the enemy of the Mura demon. You know, he always kills the demons. And Mahatpadam, those lotus feet, and that's where it has two meanings, the place where all the Mahatmas stay. You know, are the lotus feet of Krishna. And it also means the place that is sustaining the Mahatattva, the universe. In other words, the whole universe is really sustained by Krishna. And Krishna is Punya Yasha. What does that mean, Varun? Punya Yasha.
It's got pure fame, pure glory.
Well, yeah, that's literally, but it means that by glorifying him, one automatically gains punya. The kind of punya that gives bhakti. So it's punya yasha. Punya shavana kirtana, same idea. So then what happens? Bhavambudir vatsapadam. This big ocean, this impassable ocean of birth and death, shrinks down to the water in a calf's hoofprint. So it's interesting. You've taken shelter of this boat, and you don't need the boat anymore. You can just step over the ocean. It's shrunk down. In other words, it becomes very easy to cross over. Bhavambudir vatsapadam, parampadam, because one has gone to the supreme abode. Parampadam. You're already there. Even though you may appear to be here, if you're actually taking shelter of Krishna, then you're already in the spiritual kingdom. And padam padam yad vipadam natesham. Not for them who have taken shelter of that boat is this world, where at every step there is vipadam, dangers. There's dangers here. So this is what Krishna says, ividi nashtan achetasa, those who are not without Krishna consciousness, Prabhupada says, they're destroyed. It means their life after life, they're flailing around in this ocean, trying to find, you know, a little stick, you know, a stick of wood over here, some little, you know, dinghy over here that they can take shelter. It's foolish. There's no shelter here, and we can't place our hopes in this world, or we'll just keep coming back for another chance. So we should be faithful and follow this, you know, the process of karma yoga. There's karma yoga in bhakti. You know, we're working with our senses. But the difference is that we're meant to be also internally cultivating Krishna consciousness. The pure karma yogis, they're not always thinking of Krishna. They're working hard and then giving a percentage of their fruits, understanding that, oh, this is meant for, you know, service of the Lord or whatever. Or service of, you know, some higher purpose. But that's a preliminary stage. Devotees are meant to work in this way, really, text 30. You know, giving over the fruits to Krishna, but adhyatma chetasa, with full knowledge of the self at all times. And nirashi and nirmamal, without hopes of enjoying this world, and a sense of lack of proprietorship. Everything belongs to God. Okay, any questions on text 32? Yes, Prabhu.
What's the process of actually falling down into the lower species, like of a microbe? Because when you fall down from the human life, I was imagining, you know, you could take birth of a pigeon or something, or a monkey, something that's pretty close to the human form. But and when you're in an animal body, you always go up.
Yeah. Well, I always
so
took
how
it.
Get to the
I always took it to mean that you can go straight there.
Straight from human birth to germ.
There is you can imagine the kind of sinful life that would cause that. You know, those who are causing pain to many, many people, you know, mass bombings, mass murderers, and just a life of total envy and anger and cruelty. And there's a process. I think Prabhupada described this. You go to hell. You know, there's so many hells described in the fifth canto. And you're by the torment there, your consciousness is covered and covered and covered and covered more and more. So then you take birth in that. tree or that lower animal. You know, because it's almost like an act of mercy, you know, to be less conscious. Human beings can suffer more than animals, obviously more than trees or things, you know, because the nervous system, the brain, the intelligence, the mind is more developed, so you're more sensitive. But if that's taken away, if it's covered, then yeah, it's a horrible birth. But they're not, you know, how much are the amoeba, amoebae? I don't know if that's plural. How much are they really suffering? They don't even know they're suffering. You know, I mean, you don't want to take birth like that, but it's a, that's the nashtan. You know, it means for so many millions of years. You know, from the amoeba to the paramecium, you know, and then different varieties of paramecium gradually come up. You know, and then who needs that? So it's, but this is this world is, it's such a. You know, deceptive place. Even if you walk out into the forest, you know. And of course, you know, we love to be in the forest away from the big city. They have whole parks, you know, and everything. But if you get close, what's going on in that forest? It's a constant battle and war, you know. The big insects are eating the little insects. The birds are eating the insects. The cats are scaring the birds, you know. And the plants and the trees, they can't do anything. Fire is coming. Toxic waste is being spilled. You know, it's a holocaust everywhere you look. But the facade is, it's a very peaceful nature. It's not peaceful. It's a constant struggle for existence. So we don't want, this is not our home. We want to go back home, back to Godhead. Yeah.
Can I comment one thing on
that? Yeah, yeah.
We would think that nobody would desire to become an amoeba. Nobody would at least consciously say that. And so, but we also hear that the living entity is getting exactly what they want through their desires. So it can be sort of understood that if a person is doing something that's very unconscious towards the other personalities around them, like committing these heinous activities like rape and murder, it means you want to be in a situation where you don't have a consciousness of other living entities, of their awareness and their sufferings and things like that. So that sets you up for an amoeba-like existence.
That's an interesting idea. I never thought of it like that. I think that there's also the idea that, you know, as Prabhupada explained, you know, that famous painting that I'm sure you've shown to the thousands of people on the street. You know, remember? You know, you act like you want to be naked. Okay, you can take a tree body. You know, so your desire is fulfilled. You don't need a human body for that. You know, and you want to sleep a lot. Okay, you become a bear. You don't need a human brain for that. That's meant for self-realization. Just, you know, sleep nicely. You want to eat a lot of meat, the tiger body is there. And here's the guys eating a lobster, which I can be honestly say it never appealed to me. Even before, I just never could see what a lobster. Poor lobsters. I mean, that's, you know, this horrific. You know, the lobsters are alive and then they boil them when they're alive. I mean, that's low, you know. Here, you know, it's inconceivable how someone could do that. So it's a lowering of consciousness and leaving, you know, the essence of your desire intact. I think that's what you're talking about. Yeah. You're all covered over, and then you're distilled out to be, you know. It's just something that it's worth reading. The Bhagavatam is full of, you know, hair-raising stuff like this for the very reason to wake us up out of our lethargy so that we won't have any illusions about, you know, trying to enjoy in this world. That's the real problem, is the illusion of thinking that we can enjoy, that we can do some, you know, enjoy. Because that's what covers your awareness of all this stuff. That's why I like to, you know, remember I was very fortunate to work in a hospital for a while. You know, there, kind of the facade is stripped away. And you got birth, old age, disease, and death right there in front of you all the time. You know, and to work in a hospital and read the Bhagavad Gita, which was what I was doing, it was potent, you know, helped me to become interested in self-realization, associated with the devotees. Okay, let's see. I'm sorry, I lost my place. That was text 32. Let's go to text 33. Sadrusham chaishtate swasya prakatir gyanavanapi prakatim yanti bhutani nigraha kinkarishyati Even a man of knowledge acts according to his own nature, for everyone follows the nature he has acquired from the three modes. What can repression accomplish? Purport. Unless one is situated on the transcendental platform of Krishna consciousness, he cannot get free from the influence of the modes of material nature, as it is confirmed by the Lord in the 7th chapter, text 14. Who remembers what this one is? We'll discuss in a minute. Therefore, even for the most highly educated person on the mundane plane, it is impossible to get out of the entanglement of Maya simply by theoretical knowledge or by separating the soul from the body. There are many so-called spiritualists who outwardly pose as advanced in the science, but inwardly are completely under particular modes of nature which they are unable to surpass. Academically, one may be very learned, but because of his long association with material nature, he is in bondage. Krishna consciousness helps one to get out of the material entanglement, even though one may be engaged in his prescribed duties in terms of material existence. Therefore, without being fully in Krishna consciousness, one should not give up his occupational duties. No one should suddenly give up his prescribed duties and become a so-called yogi or transcendentalist artificially. It is better to be situated in one's position and to try to attain Krishna consciousness under superior training. Thus one may be freed from the clutches of Krishna's Maya. A wonderful instruction. So what can repression accomplish? You know, this is like speaking about the impersonalists or the mystic yogis who don't have a full program of activities for the senses and the mind and the voice and the intelligence and everything that can link them up through their object of meditation. You know, so therefore they have to repress. The yogis certainly repress. In the 6th chapter, it's described like that. Go out, be alone, you know, no sex life, eating very little, practicing pranayama, which is great discipline, and sitting for meditation, controlling the mind, withdrawing the senses from the sense objects. You can imagine how difficult, you know, that is. And especially for modern Kali Yugites. So, as Krishna says, what, you know, kim kudishati? What can that really accomplish for anybody, especially for ordinary persons? So, but we still have to be yogis. At the end of the 6th chapter, it says, therefore, you be a yogi. You have to be a yogi. So how are we going to do that? Well, the essence of yoga is not this repression. The essence of yoga is the linking up, one's consciousness with the Supreme. And the Supreme is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So the fact that the Supreme is the Supreme Personality of Godhead with activities and desires and a world and everything makes it possible to engage the senses, all of the senses, in the service of Krishna. And so those very senses and that very mind, which are our enemies and dragging us here and there, can, by careful guidance of the Shastra and the Guru, be purified. This purification of the desires and the senses and everything, not subjugation or repression. Because the mind is very powerful. You try to repress it, and it will rebel like anything. You know, devotees have had experience like that, when they take on too much austerity. You know, I remember a friend of mine, he's actually a nice devotee, he matured. But for the longest time, he would go through these things where, I'm not eating any sweets anymore. You know, usually that would happen right after the Sunday feast, you know. Monday was a big day for renunciation, you know. But, you know, so then, you know, some glubjiman comes along or some feast comes along and you see him, you know, not eating any. But then he would blow it out, you know, halva and sweet rice and glubjimans and everything. You know? And so then back to, you know, that's on Sunday and Monday again, you know. So better to, you know, eat moderately. So that the mind, you know, the mind is very strong, and it can take you away. You know, it's just like if a drug addict goes cold turkey, you know, or someone who's on prescription drugs. you know, and found that it's damaging and want to get off of it. Whatever the doctor will say, don't stop right away. Don't just go back to zero. Gradually, gradually, gradually. You know, reduce, reduce. Otherwise, the shock to the system and the system rebels, and it's worse than continuing the drug practice. So we're just like drug addicts. We're addicted. So we need rehabilitation. We need gradual withdrawal. And that's what the process of Krishna consciousness gives us. We have the prasadam. We have the beautiful deities, you know, the dance. If you're dancing in front of the deities and chanting, music is there, you know, then you don't hanker for the other stuff. You lose the taste. You know, there still may be some hankering at certain points, but when we come fully satisfied, then there's no more hankering. There's no more taste at all. It actually goes. And that's really what we're looking for. So therefore, be engaged in your, you know, duty according to your prescribed duty, according to your psychophysical nature, hopefully. Something that you can do for Krishna. And do it. You know, you may not be fully Krishna conscious all the time, but that's okay. But do the duty, be there. Most of it is showing up, you know. So much of it is showing up on time. And gradually the process will work, because this is the great advantage of the bhakti yogis over any other kind of yogi. Our object of meditation is the all-attractive Krishna. It comes out in the sixth chapter. You know, if you read the whole sixth chapter, there's a lot of very important instruction in there. But then at the end, you'll notice that Arjun pleads inability. How can one control this mind, you know, by force? What does he compare it to? You remember? Wind. Like, yeah, controlling the wind. You can't control the wind. It's, you know, especially if it's blowing very strong. So, chanchalam hi mana krishna pramati balavadridham. Prabhu, is it possible to sit on this side? Yeah, Hare Krishna. Just sit right over there. Tasyaham nigraham manye vayavivacha duskaram. So, Arjuna is pleading he can't do it. And Krishna says, yes, you're going to do it by practice. You know, he just outlined a bit. So then Arjuna says, all right, well, what if I fail? Now I've given up all of this ordinary life. I've gone to the forest, practiced pranayama, but then I failed. So I'm like, I lost both things. You know, I gambled and lost. And so, you know, Krishna says, no, don't worry. Anyone who does good will never be destroyed. In your next life, you'll take up where you left off. You'll be born in a family of yogis or a shuchi family, pure family, and nothing will be lost. But Arjuna's, you get the sense he's not so much satisfied with that. So then at the end, Krishna encourages him like anything. So of all the yogis, yoginam abhisarve sham, madgatena antaratmana, shantavam bhadadeyo mam samayukmomata. Now I would say, maybe you can, if I recall correctly, this is the first place in the chapter that he talks about shraddha, the faith. The faith is where the bhakti comes in. So he's saying the best yogi of all is one who always is thinking within his heart and full of faith, and worships me, bhajateya mam, semayukta momata. Now what's the next verse? Remember the next verse? Maya sakta manaparta, beginning of chapter 7. Now I'm going to teach you the yoga by which your mind can be naturally attracted to me. You see the difference? In other words, now, okay, we're through now for temporarily with the whole thing of the pranayama and that kind of thing. Now I'm going to talk to you about how you can see me everywhere. You can see me in your ordinary activities. If you remember that this is my energy, that the light of the sun and the moon is coming from me, you know? And so there's so much there. And so maya sakta mana parta. So the mind can easily be attracted to Krishna. If we simply chant his name, we simply see his form, we simply take his prasad and we associate with the devotees, you see. Because deep down inside, we're naturally attracted to Krishna. The impersonalists don't have that advantage, nor do the yogis. And therefore, their motives are different. They want to get liberation for themselves, the heck with everyone else. Or they want some siddhis. That's totally material. Totally material. To fly in the air, astral travel, walk on water. Nothing spiritual about it. It'd be very amazing, but it's not spiritual. Spiritual has to do with pure spirit, pure consciousness, and ultimately with the Supreme Spirit, Krishna. That's spiritual. So repression will not accomplish. The slow and steady, you know, gradually, moderation. That's also in the sixth chapter. You know, don't eat too much. Don't eat too little. You know, don't sleep too much. And certainly don't sleep too little either. You know, you have to be, because the mind will rebel. The body will rebel. I can't do it. You know, it's just moderate. You know, slow and steady. And you attain success in the end. Any questions on text 33? Okay. Yes?
What's Kriya Yoga? I hear that a lot.
Kriya Yoga. You know, I'm not sure. There's some pranayama in there, but I forget. You know, Kriya Yoga.
Because no one I meet on the street who says they do Kriya Yoga, they don't even know.
So. They don't know either, yeah. Whatever it is, whatever's being presented in the West, it's probably not real Kriya Yoga. Anyway. I mean, Kriya just means activity, doesn't it? It means it's kind of a sacrifice. Who knows what the, yeah?
I was just thinking, though, like, sometimes when a person, like, moves into a temple or becomes very devoted, they sometimes will go cold turkey on things. And we see many devotees are successful at doing that. So it's maybe you can just comment on this. It seems like you were alluding that by that seventh chapter that it can be done cold turkey if you sort of
I mean, there's some things you have to give up, you know. But of course, we should remember that moving into the temple is a big step. You know, if you can, fine. You know, come to the sandhifis, come to the classes, chant as much as you can, and try to follow these principles. You know. So the idea of moving into a temple, it's a big step. I mean, it's practically unheard of today in the West. Moving into the temple, what is that all about? You know, in the old days, that was what it meant to be joined to Hare Krishnas. You moved into the temple, you know. And if someone was, you know, moved out of the temple, you feel they're lost. You know, they go off and, you know, after a while we realize, well, wait a minute, these people who live outside the temple, we need them, you know, the experienced devotees. But the point is that it's rare that someone comes from, you know, blazing away with the four sinful activities to suddenly coming into the temple and giving it up. You know, there's usually a transition. I mean, mostly, I mean, tell me if I'm wrong about this, but mostly people are vegetarians, you know, before they even get seriously interested in practicing Krishna consciousness. I know that was true for me. That, and it's, you know, it's in the Shastra. You're really killing yourself, you know, spiritually, if you just insist on eating meat. So, in one sense, you're right. I mean, it's there is a point at which you just have to say no. You know, it's not gonna happen even a little bit anymore. You know, and that you find it's a wonderful thing because the intensity of Krishna consciousness gives you the experience of being able to do things that you thought you could never do. You know, giving up so many things and accepting things. And you can see by the history of this movement, you know, how go alone to start a temple in Germany, in Hamburg somewhere. This one devotee I knew, you know, he did that in the early days. Incredible. What do they have to sustain him? Basically, probably the letters. There's no question of phone calls, internet, email, nothing. The letters would come, you know, every couple of days. And, you know, he kept his faith and he was chanting and started ISKCON Germany. You know, and so many devotees did that. And so it's, who could imagine that before, just 5 years or 2 years before actually doing something like that? So that's a great faith builder, when you're able to give up something you never thought you'd give up or take on something you never thought you could take on by the power of the holy name, by the power of the process of devotion. It's great. All right, one more. 34, right? Indriyasyendriyasyarte Ragadvesho vivastitao Tayo na vashamagachi Tao yasya paripantinao. There are principles to regulate attachment and aversion pertaining to the senses and their objects. One should not come under the control of such attachment and aversion because they are stumbling blocks on the path of self-realization. Purport. Those who are in Krishna consciousness are naturally reluctant to engage in material sense gratification. But those who are not in such consciousness should follow the rules and regulations of the revealed scriptures. Unrestricted sense enjoyment is the cause of material encagement. But one who follows the rules and regulations of the revealed scriptures does not become entangled by the sense objects. For example, sex enjoyment is a necessity for the conditioned soul, and sex enjoyment is allowed under the license of marriage ties. According to scriptural injunctions, one is forbidden to engage in sex relationships with any women other than one's wife. All other women are to be considered as one's mother. But in spite of such injunctions, a man is still inclined to have sex relationships with other women. These propensities are to be curbed. Otherwise, they will be stumbling blocks on the path of self-realization. As long as the material body is there, the necessities of the material body are allowed, but under rules and regulations. And yet, we should not rely upon the control of such allowances. One has to follow those rules and regulations unattached to them, because practice of sense gratification under regulations may also lead one to go astray, as much as there is always the chance of an accident, even on the royal roads. Although they may be very carefully maintained, no one can guarantee that there will be no danger even on the safest road. The sense enjoyment spirit has been current for a very long, long time, owing to material association. Therefore, in spite of regulated sense enjoyment, there is every chance of falling down. Therefore, any attachment for regulated sense enjoyment must also be avoided by all means. But attachment to Krishna consciousness, or acting always in the loving service of Krishna, detaches one from all kinds of sensory activities. Therefore, no one should try to be detached from Krishna consciousness at any stage of life. The whole purpose of detachment from all kinds of sense attachment is ultimately to become situated on the platform of Krishna consciousness. So it's very, intuitive to kind of think of Krishna consciousness in terms of attachment. Because when you think about it, you know, our life is really meant, it's going from one attachment to another. The ordinary person, the mind, you know, and the heart, they're full of all kinds of desires and attachments and aversions, which is the flip side. And on the basis of those, you're acting every day. Someone's going to work every day. Why? Well, of course, you got to make some money, pay the rent, because you're attached to living inside, not on the street. Or you have a family, and you know you're attached to them. You want to support the husband when the women work, and the man wants to support the wife, the kids. You know, there's all kinds of attachments. There's like ropes everywhere, subtle attachments, and of course. You know, to get over the pain that comes from working under, you know, some mean boss somewhere. You know, no one likes to go to work, basically, almost. Then you have your other attachments, you know, your entertainment, your free time, your weekends, you know, where you can go out and get intoxicated or whatever, dancing and playing video games, who knows what. You know, there's a whole battery. There's a million things. You know, and people are living in that cloud of attachments, right, and aversions. And sometimes you're giving them up. Like as you get older or you change partners, you know, it's very painful. But then it's kind of, the wound is anodized, you know, and you have no feeling anymore. Then it's transferred to someone else, something else. Isn't it? It's going like that. So Krishna consciousness means to scientifically, you know, transfer the attachment to Krishna. So it has both things. One has to become detached, you know. And the best way to do it, you know, out of sight, out of mind, there's also that aspect. That's called tyag, you know. If you don't see, I mean, let's face it, you know, three blocks from the beach is not the ideal place you would put a brahmachari ashram, you know, in Southern California. But isn't it amazing? We have, you know, an ashram full of brahmacharis that shows how powerful this process is. You know, you don't go out on the beach ogling, you know, the ladies there. You know, that's understood. But if you're strong enough, you can go out there and distribute books. And you come back and you have a big kirtan. And we're good. You know, another day in brahmacharya life. It's truly miraculous when you think of it. But you know, because it's the attachment. Krishna, he fills the heart. You know, if you're always chanting his name, you'll never be attached to anything in this world. You'll be attached to Krishna and to his holy name. The problem is that we forget to chant. We allow the mind to get distracted. We stop chanting. We stop thinking of Krishna. And then we're fair game. You know, Maya's hooks are trying to get us. So that's why we have all these rules and regulations. You know, okay, you know, I'm not feeling overwhelming attachment to Krishna, you know, and I'm also not feeling overwhelming attachment to Maya. I'm kind of in that penumbric state, you know, when I could go either way. Okay, well, I know the rules and regulations. Time to take rest. Time to get up. You know I want to sleep and still keep dreaming about that. No, got to get up. You know, so that's these rules and regulations. They're like barriers or guides that help us to go stay on the path. You know, so that's called vidhi or vaidhi bhakti. And why accept the rules? Because we revere the higher authority that's given us the rules. We know that this book has not been written to make money, to fame. Obviously, it's been spoken by Krishna and expanded on by Prabhupada and previous acharyas for our benefit, wholly and solely, so that we can come in. Why does Krishna come here? You know, he's perfectly blissful in the spiritual. Why does he take the trouble to come here? Wholly and solely out of his mercy, compassion. Because we're all his children, and we're wallowing around, suffering so much, like some kid in a playpen, you know, who's banging his head and hurting himself, and yet he needs the higher authorities to straighten him out. You know, that's what we're doing. So he's come here and sent his emissaries, and all these books and everything, all this, everything has been created simply out of compassion and mercy. So if we understand that, and we have faith, the Shraddha comes in, then we'll accept the authority of the higher rules. That means duty. You know, that's the first, a very important first step in Vaidhi. Yes, it's my duty to you know, do all the things in the morning, leading up to the day, and so many things I should do during the day. I'm not spontaneously attracted to doing the pots, you know. But it's my duty, my turn, okay, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it nicely. I'm going to do it nicely for Krishna and Prabhupada and my spiritual master. That's a very advanced platform. And while you're doing it, I like to, you know, remember when I was in Miami for 6 years, from 83 to 89, we were working on the Bhagavatam, the 10th canto, 11th canto, 12th canto, you see, Gopi Pranadana, who would, Maharaj, Ridhinanda Maharaj produced them, I was helping them. So we lived in this big temple. It's Krishna's arrangement, how it happened. Govinda's Vaikuntha building, it was called. And it was a big hotel right on the beach, not Pacific Beach, Miami Beach. You know, I could see the water practically fall out my window when I was in the water. And there we were, and, you know, on the beach, again on the beach. I've been on the beach for 25 years now. And so, but our duty as a BBT members, you know, we had a crew there, was to do the pots after the Sunday feast. Now, you know, after the Sunday feast, no one spontaneously, unless you're really advanced, wants to do the pots. Nityagaur, Heli is spontaneously. But anyway. All right, we have to do it. So you put on, we had these big rubber things, you know, like aprons and things we put, and boots, and get in there, and it's sloshing around, you know. All right. But we're chanting, kirtan. You know, and after a while, we're chanting Hare Krishna, you know, in kirtan, banging the pots a little bit. And boy, that was you come out of it blissful as anything. You know? So what was duty turned into another blissful engagement, devotional service. If you have to do it for money, you know, if you're getting paid $5.50 an hour, and whatever it is, you know, the minimum wage, then it's pure suffering. You're thinking of, you know, something else. You know, it's just drudgery. But in Krishna consciousness, nothing is drudgery, ultimately. If you're Krishna conscious, that's why Prabhupada keeps throwing it in here. But one who's fully Krishna conscious. So the vidhi becomes raga, you know, the real nice attachment for Krishna. That's where the raga nuga comes in. And we should have faith that that can really happen. But you have to work to get to that point by accepting the duties and being, ethical about it and following one's activities nicely. So that's what's going on here. Yes, Arya Siddhanta.
Can you go in depth about how attachment and aversion are two sides of the same?
Well, yeah, in the material world, because, you know, the whole criteria, you know, criterion is, are my senses being pleased? You know, are my senses being pleased? So sometimes the senses are pleased, but other times, involuntarily, they're not being pleased. So that's the basic, you know, criterion for is it good or bad. So if it's pleasing, then you're attached to it, you're attracted. And if it's displeasing, you try to avoid it, try to negate it, try to, you know, dull the pain, whatever it is. So because it's the senses and because the world is constantly changing, sometimes there's going to be pleasure, sometimes there's going to be pain. Just like this body. Well, you can't always keep it comfortable. You know, now, you know, in San Diego, the temperature is quite moderate. But, you know, I was up in Winnipeg in Canada, and it was super hot. I mean, it was like weird, you know. I'm in the north, way above, but it was like in the 90s. And so that was unpleasant. It's just unpleasant. All right, put the fans on. At one point, I was putting, you know, wet towels on me with the fan. I was living in an attic with no air conditioning, you know, for 5 days, 90, 95, muggy. You know, you can't get comfortable. That's the material world. And sometimes, more seriously, you get some disease. You just can't, you have to, what can you do? You know, so that's, if you're always trying to satisfy your senses in this world, you'll always be frustrated. Even if you're able to get something that's pleasurable, it passes away. It's not, you know, it you have to stop. The senses have their limits. And even if you try to avoid as much as possible pain, it comes at you. I like to quote this verse from Prahlad Maharaj. He says, Yasmat priya priya viyoga sa yoga janma shoka agnina sakala yonasha dayamana. So in two lines, he describes the whole material condition. So priya apriya viyoga sanyoga. So that which is dear, priya. So many things are dear to us, right? But they're forcibly taken away, viyoga. And that which is apriya, painful, are forcibly forced upon us. And this he describes as like a big fire of lamentation. Both things, when you think about it, bring about great anger or fear or lamentation, right? The dearest thing is ripped away. The horrible thing in your face. You know, shok agnina, and not just once. Okay, I can tolerate this life and then I'll be nothing. No, sakala yonishu dayamana. I'm burning in this fire of lamentation, birth after birth, different bodies, different species. Great, that's the material world. So naturally we try to cure this problem, right? So this is called a dukkha aushadhi. The misery of both sides of the misery. You know, the dear things being taken away in the bed. So it's called dukkha aushadham. But they just produce more misery. Dukkha aushadham tadapi dukkham. Now what do I do? All my remedies are coming up short. You know, I like to point out, here we are sitting here very peacefully, more or less. All around us, the world is burning. Riots in England. You know, stock market crashing, you know, Europe, everyone's on edge. What's going to happen to the euro? Oh, we've lost trillions of dollars, you know. You know, that's the things that most dear, money is the honey, is taken away. Well, you have it, but it's only worth half of what it was yesterday. So that's another way to take it away, right? It becomes worthless. So this is the material life. So we try to remedy it. The big bankers get together. Okay, we'll lend here, we'll do here, we'll, you know, we'll trick them over here, you know. That's called dukkha aushadham. Tadapi dukkham, cause more misery. It's proven every day around us, all around. So, and all because of one point, atadhyaham, means I think I am, dhyaham, something I'm not. Atadhyaham. I think I'm the body, but I'm pure spirit. It all starts there. Atadhyaham. So what's, now that's three lines of the verse. He's painted a very bleak picture, seemingly hopeless because of illusion. So the next line he prays, Bhuman Brahmami Vadameta Vadasya Yogam. My dear Lord, this is Prahlad praying to Lord Nrisimhadev, who's Krishna. He says, Oh great Lord, Bhuman Brahmami Vadameta, I who am wandering in this world and who am bewildered by all this, Brahmami means both things. Please, Vadasya Yogam, speak to me of your bhakti yoga, your dasya yoga. Your yoga, how I can be servant of you. Prahlad taking the role of a conditioned soul. So we can you know, understand so much from that one verse. You know, is that there's no hope. There is no hope of materially solving the problems in this world. There's no hope for material solutions to material problems. Only spiritual solutions solve all the problems. You know, we have to have full faith that Krishna consciousness is the actual solution to all the problems in the world. personal, physical, emotional, economical, whatever you go, you know, existential, ontological. Take your pick. Krishna consciousness is really the solution. And it's all explained very logically. And with that faith, we can accept duty and act on the basis of it. Any final comments or questions? We're almost out of time. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.